the thing about it is, I'm 20 years away from this stuff. I pick up things I wrote and I say to myself, did I write that? You know, this one, this particular opinion I remember only vaguely, but I apparently had divided Boykin, what I called Boykinism, into three categories. And the first was pure Boykinism, which holds that the record of a guilty plea to pass constitutional muster must contain a statement of advice by the judge to the defendant that he has three constitutional rights: trial by jury, the right to confront his accusers, the right not to be a witness against himself, and secondly, a statement by the defendant, separate and apart from his guilty plea, by which the defendant expressly waives each of these rights on the record. Then I talked about orthodox Boykinism, which called the guilty plea itself the waiver, but insists on a judicial statement of advice. And then finally I referred to a thing which I called ecumenical Boykinism, which does not require the judge to play the role of the defense attorney. It merely requires a recitation of constitutional rights either on the record or on a piece of paper duly signed in the defendant's own hand. This particular controversy troubled me substantially because the court was getting into a kind of formalism that almost marked the courts of common law, you know, centuries ago, where they were departing from substance. I mean, if I can, if it may be a confusing concept, but procedural substance. That is the substantive reason for the procedural rights that we afford defendants in criminal cases. But when a person pleads guilty, they voluntarily place themselves within the jurisdiction of the court and the power of the court to send them to prison or deal with them as a person who's convicted of a crime. And it's obvious that we don't want people pleading guilty who aren't guilty or whose decision to plead guilty has been affected by fraud or duress, or anything other than a free and voluntary choice on their part. But of course, all human beings who have their faculties are made with the faculty of free will. And they all have the capacity to make free choices. Some people make much more intelligent, informed, careful, prudent choices than other people. And in most instances, the people who are defendants in criminal cases are not among that category. In most cases, the people who are accused of crime and who are pleading guilty in criminal cases are people whose intellect is not among the top, who are certainly free individuals and sui generis in the sense that they're responsible for their own actions, but in the eyes of an educated jurist, they may have an extremely simplistic view of life and simplistic view of their own dilemma as they stand before the court. But I'm not prepared to say that simplistic understanding of their predicament isn't adequate for a human being to make a free and voluntary judgment. So what I'm saying is, you could stand there all day long and lecture some of these defendants about the Constitution and their rights. But communication is a two-way street. It's not just what's said. It's what's understood. It's what's received. It's a sender and a receiver. And anybody who's taught in a school or a college or addressed a jury has to know that what you say isn't always understood by the people you're talking to in the same sense in which you say it. Now, I think a lot of this Boykin controversy was an attempt on the part of some of our judges to have this kind of perfect understanding of the defendant's predicament from which he would have this full totally informed capacity to make a judgment. And his judgment about being guilty or not guilty was made in that context. In my opinion, it was an attempt to achieve some perfection of human nature that doesn't exist. The Constitution provided that people are entitled to counsel, and the Sixth Amendment, I guess it is. And these people all had lawyers. Well, what's the function of the lawyer? The function of the lawyer is to advise the client. That's what he's paid for. That's what he's educated to do. And presumably, he advises these clients in the language that they can understand. He dialogues with the client in the jail. And if the man speaks in broken English, or if he speaks in an ethnic patois, maybe the lawyer dialogues with him in street talk in the same way that he understands things. But it's the responsibility of the lawyer and the thing he's trained to do to make sure that he conveys the information to his client about what his rights are and what his choices are. And it used to be in the old days that the lawyer stood before the judge and said, "Your Honor, I have advised the defendant of his constitutional rights. He fully understands them and he wishes to enter a plea of guilty." And that statement was given weight. It was regarded as a significant statement on the record that the proving, in fact, that the defendant was advised of his constitutional rights. Well, Boykin said, "We don't trust the lawyer. And we're not going to accept the lawyer's representation that he's informed the defendant of his constitutional rights. We're going to inform him of his constitutional rights from the bench and put the process of informing him on the record." Well, the process of informing him on the record is a formal juristic statement of rights, maybe completely accurate within the Constitution. I assume it assuredly completely accurate within the meaning of the Constitution, but always done with the pomp and sterility of judicial discourse, and done in open court in front of a crowd of people on the big day when the man is in court before the judge and his heart is pounding in his throat, and the idea that he's going to understand what he's being told, or that's a circumstance in which you're going to be able to give him information and have him exercise intelligent choice on the basis of it, is ludicrous. Absolutely ludicrous. But we went through this whole charade, and we're still going through the whole charade. We do it for whatever reason. In my opinion, what we were doing then, and none of the judges would admit it, none of the justices on our court would admit it, and the justices of the United States Supreme Court wouldn't admit it, but what we were doing, as far as I'm concerned, was we were trying to find a way to get involved in sentencing, in sentence review. When a person was sent to Jackson Prison for 20 years on his guilty plea, and he'd been up there for 15 or 18 years, the only way he could get out was to attack his conviction. And since he pled guilty, how are you going to attack the conviction? The only way you get anybody to resentence him or to review it is time in prison. And there was a feeling on the part of many of our judges that some of the sentences were too severe. They had no track to get to that other than to order retrials and guilty pleas. And in my personal opinion, that's what they were doing.